Good day and welcome to the Inside the Beltway conference call. And at this time, I'll turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riesch. Please go ahead, sir.
Derek, thank you very much, and good morning to most of the country and good afternoon to the East Coast. We're glad to be with you again. This is our 30th quarterly call, and amazingly, we've been doing this for 7.5 years. I hope it's provided 7.5 years of value to you all. I'm on the call today with three of my partners and with Jim Dolan from NetTixus. Let me introduce them. With me, I'm Fred Riesch. I'm in the Los Angeles of Drinker Biddle, and I head what's called the Financial Services ERISA team, and we co-chair another group called the Best Interest Compliance Team, meaning that my practice focuses on duties of care, conflicts of interest, and disclosures. With me from our Washington, D.C. office is Brad Campbell, who many of you all remember was the Assistant Secretary at the Employee Benefits Security Administration before returning to private practice. Also with me is Sandy Granum. Sandy works out of our Florham Park, New Jersey office and our New York City office. Sandy is the head of our FINRA group. And finally, among the Drinker Biddle attorneys is Jim Lundy. And Jim was with SEC Examinations and Enforcement before joining the firm. He's a partner in the firm and is one of the key players in our securities and litigation world. Also with us is Jim Dolan. And I mentioned he was with NetTixus, but he's got a title there that tells you about what he does. He's the Vice President for Retirement Strategies at NetTixus Investment Manager. So he's a retirement guy like most of us. This session is being recorded so that you know. And the recording will be available. It takes a couple days to get it up, but we'll put it on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com. There's a tab called Insights and Events. But don't worry about that, because everybody who registered for the call today will get an email with a link when it's posted. So you don't even have to remember the website. If you want to go listen to it later or refer it to one of your colleagues, great. Feel free to do that. Also, at the end of the session, we're going to open up the lines for questions and answers, and I'll make an announcement when we're at that point. By the way, some people pre-submitted questions, and we always try to respect that and get to those. Some of the questions we plan to answer during the session. Others we'll handle at the end. Jim, NetTixus and you sponsor us. You've been great sponsors. We really appreciate your support. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to.
Certainly, Fred. Appreciate it very much. I think it's been a great partnership over the past 7.5 years. And you know, we appreciate everyone calling in and listening to all the thought leadership. I'd love to tell you a little bit more about NetTixus. You know, we're an asset management shop. We represent about 20 specialized investment managers globally, and we focus on active management. And in my world, in the retirement side of the business, we very much focus on increasing participation rates and providing sustainable investments to the retirement space. We actually are the only firm that offers a sustainable focused target date series. And that's just coming up on about 3 years. So it's a great way, we think, to engage millennials in the workforce and people who want more transparency and understanding about how their retirement funds are invested. So certainly appreciate, again, everyone calling in today and want to thank Drinker Biddle for the partnership. And with that, Fred, I'll turn it back to you.
And vice versa, Jim. We really appreciate it. Really appreciate it also. Thank you. Well, let's jump into the deep end of the pool here. And the first item on our agenda, as the announcement that you all saw says, is a report on the lawsuits that were filed, to vacate interest. I know that both Brad and Jim Lundy, did one of you guys want to jump in and then the other follow?
Well, this is Brad. Maybe I'll jump in first. And I can't believe it's been 7.5 years. I'm not sure whether I'm happy about that or depressed about that in terms of the time that's gone by. But So, as you all probably saw a few weeks back, seven states in the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit in federal court seeking to have regulation best interest vacated on a couple of grounds. And one of their arguments was that it didn't follow the requirements in Dodd-Frank, that Section 913 of Dodd-Frank directed the SEC to carry out a study of whether there should be a uniform fiduciary standard for broker-dealers and RIAs, and that while it conducted that report and that report said that they should develop a uniform standard, they didn't. They did something else, and that was not what the law told them to do. The SEC, if I don't think they've formally responded yet, but personally, I think there's some pretty good counterarguments to that, namely that Dodd-Frank actually provided a separate grant of authority to do something other than a fiduciary, uniform fiduciary standard, which is the citation the SEC made, among others, for its authority when it did the rule. The states also argued that they had standing to bring this lawsuit because it would reduce the future revenues they would collect from accounts and distributions from those accounts, because those distributions would be reduced by the excessive fees and other problems caused by not having a fiduciary standard, which I think is kind of a novel and legally very aggressive position to take for standing, and it'll be interesting to see how the courts deal with that as well. And ultimately, they argued that it was an arbitrary and capricious rulemaking as well for not coming out in the directions that these states wish them to have. So I think if I were going to offer a color commentary, and let me, of course, caution that I'm not a securities lawyer or a litigator, so take that for what it's worth, but it seems to me that these are really more political posturings than they are credible legal maneuvers, that it's really sending a message that there are a large number of pretty significant states. The seven states included California, New York, Connecticut, then some others, Maine, Delaware. But it indicated that there's some significant political interest among some of these states in saying that regulation best interest was not the right policy solution. And it fits in with the actions of some other states like Nevada, Massachusetts, and New Jersey to pursue their own state-level fiduciary regulations. So I think it's more indicative of a political split and a policy split between the federal government and the states, and that this lawsuit is one of the several ways that's manifesting sort of that collision course that we're seeing the feds and the states being on. Jim, what would you add to that would probably be more more legal analysis and less policy commentary?
Actually, not much more, Brad. I thought you did an excellent job covering it. I share your view in that I think there's other agendas in play. You know, what was interesting is historical rulemaking challenges recently with the DOL, as you all have much deeper expertise than I do. But before that, with the SEC, which some folks called the Merrill Lynch rule, before it was overturned in the D.C. Circuit, the efforts to get involved in rulemaking challenges have typically been led by industry groups. And thus far, that has not been the case here. Because of some of the, you know, what I think folks interpreted as frustration by investor advocacy groups, there was some thought that those groups may attempt to lead any challenges related to these rulemakings. But what we were left with ultimately was that collection of states. And then there's another lawsuit that was filed by two firms. I share your perspective, Brad, in that I think the agencies and the SEC, having lived through its own experience from the Merrill Lynch rule and having watched from afar the DOL's experience, really tried to be mindful in this process of best managing the risk of a rulemaking challenge. So, if I were a betting man, and I'm not, but if I were, coupled with the fact I think, you know, the SEC is going to do everything it can to be successful, I think that the challenges ultimately are not going to be successful. Of course, there's a lot of time that's going to pass and a lot of variables at play. But that brings me to another point, which is occasionally we've gotten questions. I know we all have at Drinker about what this means for the implementation date of June 30th, 2020. You know, the abrupt answer is not much. The current status of the legal challenges and expected procedural process as it plays out should not impact that. And another thing to bear in mind, as I understand it, and I'm sure someone will jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, these challenges are to Reg BI. There's other components of the rulemaking package, in particular the finalization of the rule regarding Form CRS. Thus far, that particular rule has not been subjected to challenge, as I recall and understand it. So in terms of firms planning and implementation looking forward, other than continuing to monitor how these lawsuits play out, I think the planning and implementation and ultimately execution to be in compliance needs to proceed.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'd put it even more bluntly. It almost doesn't matter how these play out. We don't have the time to wait to deal with the implementation given the amount of work that has to happen by broker-dealers between now and June. We have to go full steam ahead because there isn't really any other practical option.
Sandy, and I want you to follow up on that because you represent more broker-dealers than the three of us do. I was on the phone with a broker-dealer yesterday, and this was one of the first questions that came up on the call. And I said to them that I think you have to do so much work to get ready for Reg BI. And I think people are underestimating how much work has to be done. But I think you have to do so much work to get ready for Reg BI. You really don't have a choice. You have to be working on it as if the rule is going to come into effect. Although I agree with Jim and Brad, I think the odds are pretty long that these lawsuits will be successful. But, Sandy, is that what you're saying to your clients, too?
Absolutely. I mean, FINRA has made a point of telling its members, get ready. It's June 2020. If you need help, call us. Here are some numbers at the SEC you can call as well. But our expectation is that we will be enforcing as to Reg BI come July 2020. I think with the DOL rule, there was the smaller maybe houses that were holding back to see what the bigger houses would do and waiting to see if there would be an ability to sort of ride the coattails. I don't think that's going to be an option here. We have 12 months, less than that at this point, to get it together, and FINRA has already announced that it will be examining as to this particular rule.
And Jim, to go back to one thing, you said. Oh, okay, good. That makes me feel better. I'm always glad when I agree with you, Sandy. That makes me feel great and like I'm did a nice job for the client. But Jim, to go back to one thing you said, about other guidance that accompanied this. I don't think there's a general realization among the investment advisor community, particularly regional and local firms, that the RIA guidance is already effective and already applicable, that on July 12th, it applied, and people are expected to be living with that from July 12 on, if not before. And because I'm just not seeing the amount of interest in the RIA community in knowing what the rules say and in trying to revise their disclosure documents to adjust to the new world, if you will. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree. It has been effective since July 12th, and I think the staff would take the position that their RIA guidance, when finalized on June 5th, confirmed and clarified the fiduciary duty guidance of the SEC that had long been in place. I have a slight disagreement with that because this is the first pronouncement by the commission, the body that is in charge of that agency on this particular issue. As you've heard me say before, Fred, the word fiduciary in a word search does not historically show up in the Advisors Act, and the guidance acknowledges that. Most firms have probably developed, very strong compliance and supervisory policies and procedures regarding conflicts and disclosures over the years. What we're talking to our clients about and saying publicly, and I spoke on this the other day at a conference, is nevertheless, you should still go through the guidance very closely and develop a process to make sure that your policies and procedures and practices are consistent with this guidance. The guidance talks about the fiduciary duty obligation with some level of specificity and provide some guidance in that regard. And so I think it's a very helpful exercise for RIA firms to go through that. And on top of that, and I know we talked about this a little bit, Fred, the Investment Management Division recently issued an FAQ last Friday, October 18th, regarding disclosure of certain financial conflicts related to investment advisor compensation. So, again, I think when you couple what was just released in terms of this FAQ guidance with that July 12th effective date, firms on the RIA side of the house for dual registrants or standalone RIAs need to be taking this guidance to heart. I have a couple of clients that were in the middle of examinations that were started long before the June 5th guidance was finalized and released. When they received deficiency letters, that guidance was being cited to chapter and verse to support findings, and unfortunately at times very serious findings. So it is already being considered by exam staff in the field as the standard that has been in place and that has been in place for some time.
Yeah, I just to give a couple of examples to everybody, so we're not just talking about rules, we have some practical aspects to it. The SEC says that a recommendation of a rollover from a, let's say, a 401k plan to an IRA is a conflict of interest. And I'm going through the ADVs for RIA firms that I work with, and I'm not finding a disclosure of that conflict of interest in the ADVs. So we're drafting it and putting it in. And that's just one little example of what I think first is an expanded view of conflicts of interest that the SEC is taking. Every way in which you can make a recommendation or a decision and make more money as a result is a conflict of interest. Then it has to be disclosed. The disclosure rules are changing significantly. And Jim, we can get back to that subject because we're going to talk about the Secure Act first, but then we want to come back to a couple of cases that the SEC has recently filed against advisors. Brad, let me segue to you for the second topic on today's call, which is the Secure Act. And basically, it's just, where is it? What's going on? Will we get it? So what do you say, Brad?
Well, that is the big question, and a lot of that depends on what the Senate ends up doing in deal-making around the end of the year bills. So just to review the bidding, the House of Representatives passed almost unanimously, 417-3, the Secure Act, which is a package of retirement-related tax reform provisions. A lot of very interesting ones in there for plans. It increases the auto escalation safe harbor to 15%. It changes RMD age to 72. It gets rid of the age limit for contributions to IRAs. It puts in place a safe harbor for selecting an annuity provider for plans. There's just a whole host of provisions in there, little rifle shot provisions that taken as a whole would be fairly useful. There's also a couple that have raised a few eyebrows. One of them, for example, says that if a plan sponsor has employees who work 500 or more hours in three consecutive years, they would now be eligible for participation in the retirement plan. And that's raised some questions about compliance and other issues. But by and large, it's been a pretty popular package. And when it got to the Senate, it ran into the need to either pass by unanimous consent or have the Senate do an alternative version. And for the Senate to do an alternative version of the House bill would take months and months. But unfortunately, they also haven't been able to get unanimous consent, all 100 senators, to agree to let the bill go forward. There's a few senators who have some issues with certain provisions. And they've been trying to work those out. Just recently, last week, a group of about eight Republican senators sent a letter to Leader McConnell saying, hey, we really want this to go forward. There is bipartisan support for moving it forward. The best hope for the bill is probably that it gets included or some version of it gets included in a big end-of-the-year omnibus bill of things that must pass because they haven't been finished yet. And if they're able to work out a deal, there's certainly a chance the Secure Act or something very similar to it could become law in one of those bills. Again, assuming it gets into those bills and whatever those bills are acceptable to the president and we don't run into, you know, some other big picture budget showdown over those bills. So wrap all that up. It's still uncertain, but certainly these provisions aren't dead. I would say, it's hard to handicap. I would say it's probably a little less than 50-50 that it actually happens, but it's certainly a possibility, and it's something there's a lot of people working to try to get the Senate to make some forward progress on.
Brad, you handicapped this year. Let's say we don't get it this year. Will you handicap next year for us too?
Well, I think because of the bipartisan nature of it, because the Secure Act was produced by Chairman Neal in the House Ways and Means Committee, who is obviously a Democrat, and that made it through the entire House leadership and was approved by the party, so to speak. I think there's clear interest on that side, and there's clear interest on the Republican side. Obviously, who wins the presidency is, you know, a big wild card for the future. In terms of next year itself, before we get to the presidential election, I think there's a chance they could take another run at it, but the question would be, have they resolved those same issues that are holding it up now? It strikes me that there's a better chance of getting it passed this year than there is next year, simply because next year becomes more and more about the election and that kind of fighting. And if you didn't have a deadline forcing a conclusion on some of these outlying issues that are holding it up now, why would it be better? Why would there be a better likelihood of getting a resolution next year? So my personal opinion, for what it's worth, is if it's going to happen, it probably needs to happen this year. But the concepts here have gotten bipartisan approval, so they're going to hang around. If there is another tax bill, if there is another opportunity, either next year or after the presidential election and the next congressional election and the next Congress, I think we'll see these ideas stay, and some of them will make it through. The question is just, what's the vehicle and what's the timing?
Brad, listening to you talk about it, it reminds me of an old saying that there are two things that children should never see, and those are how sausage and legislation are made.
Unfortunately, there is a lot of truth to that. You can have nearly unanimous agreement on most of the provisions in this bill, and yet it doesn't make it through. The only thing I'll say in defense of gridlock is, depending on your political perspective at any given time, gridlock has either been the greatest thing ever or the worst thing ever. So I'll say that probably balances out, saying that, you know, things being hard for Congress to do is not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay, we'll wrap up the Secure Act with that. That's a good way to end. Let's turn over to Jim Lundy. And Jim, in recent months, the SEC has filed a couple of cases that seem to come out of the Share Class Selection Disclosure Initiative, and they seem to be taking some fairly aggressive positions in cases against investment advisors. Will you fill us in on what's going on?
Sure. Thanks, Fred. And these two cases are cases that are related to the initiative. They are not defendants, because they're U.S. District Court complaints. They're not defendants who participated, but the cases and the charges align with the aggressive activity that we've seen and been following, Fred, regarding disclosure violations, in particular regarding 12b-1 fees and revenue sharing. So the first one came out in early August, and when it came out, I think it jumped out to some people because of the large dollar amount at issue, which is over $100 million in revenue sharing and disgorgement that the SEC is seeking. At the time, some folks interpreted this as well to be a matter involving potentially the initiative directly. But that's actually not the case. Unfortunately for this particular defendant, they did participate in the initiative in the first wave. And unfortunately, because the revenue sweep that the SEC initiated came out in December of 2018, they were then charged separately in a new action in this complaint filed in early August, alleging disclosure violations related to revenue sharing, and also with the SEC seeking over $100 million in disgorgement. A couple of things that were interesting about this are that it related to perhaps, and I've heard this third or fourth hand, the SEC's aggressive position regarding seeking tolling agreements. So I don't have any insight into this, and this would be a non-public decision by the staff. But I have heard from some people who have said that they have heard that part of the reason for this action being taken when it was taken and with the aggression of the allegations related to perhaps this firm advising the staff that they were not going to agree to an additional tolling agreement extension. So when firms hear and get frustrated about these tolling agreement extensions, and the veiled threat is that the SEC will take a quick action if you don't agree, to the extent what I've heard is accurate, this is an example of that occurring. That's not to indicate in any way that a tolling agreement with the SEC is a very serious decision, and each firm that should decide whether to enter into that in terms of what is the best strategy for them. But to the extent...
Jim, let me interrupt for one second. If I understood what you were saying correctly, that one of the firms, there are two cases involving different firms, but in one of the cases, they went in under the share class selection disclosure initiative on the 12b1 fees, and that got resolved under the voluntary program. Is that right? But then the SEC also found that they had revenue sharing they were receiving from custodians, perhaps, and that's the subject of the litigation. Did I get that right? Is that how it divides out?
You're correct. This particular entity participated in the share class selection disclosure initiative at a settlement that was released as part of what many of us have called the first wave with the other 70-something firms. And then, approximately 3 to 4 months later, was charged by the SEC in a litigated proceeding with disclosure violations related to the revenue sharing arrangement that they had.
Okay, for people listening who aren't familiar with the SCSDI, the Share Class Selection Disclosure Initiative, it only applied to 12b-1 fees. You could only go in under the voluntary program if you had received 12b-1 fees that either weren't disclosed or that weren't adequately disclosed on the SEC's new high disclosure standards. And that's why the Share Class Selection Initiative didn't protect them from the revenue sharing claim. Now, to take that one step further, what I have heard and seen is that the way the SEC then found out about the revenue sharing payments was they went to the custodians that investment advisors use and said, hey, tell us everybody you're making revenue sharing payments to. They got that information from the custodians, and that then initiated, what were those? Were those examinations, or did they actually start off with enforcement actions?
They started off with enforcement investigations with document requests issued to firms around the country in December of 2018.
And if I understand the SEC's approach, Jim, that's when they start off an enforcement rather than exams. That's an indication that they're taking it seriously, more seriously.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt. I was just afraid there were some people on the call that might not be familiar with the SCSDI, and I thought I better get them aligned with us.
No, that was great, Fred, and I'll cover the second matter as well, because that potentially has some new areas that I think folks want to be paying attention to. So approximately a month later, the SEC filed another litigated case, and there were four categories of disclosure charges. The first two I'm not going to talk about at length because they've been talked about a lot. One of them is disclosure violations related to 12b-1 fees. And again, while related at a general level, not specifically related to the initiative, because this piece of the case developed from a referral by the examination staff to the enforcement division. So perhaps this particular entity was not eligible for the initiative. But nevertheless, they were then charged outside of the initiative with disclosure violations, the first of which related to 12b-1 fees. The second related to revenue sharing, and we just talked about that. But the third and the fourth are areas that the SEC has explored in the past, but the volume of activity, both by the examination program and the enforcement program in these two areas, have not been as deep, and there has not been as much coverage of either. So the first category that is charged in addition to 12b-1 fees and revenue sharing is allegations in the complaint related to the advisor's receipt of administrative service fees. And what that involved is that the advisor entered into administrative service agreements with the clearing broker for them to be paid for services to the clearing broker, such as handling client inquiries, maintaining client accounts, and trade correction processing. For those services, the clearing broker agreed to pay the advisor 25% of the service fees. The SEC has alleged that that arrangement is not sufficiently disclosed, and therefore that conflict of interest is a violation of the Advisors Act. The fourth set of allegations involves the advisor failing to disclose compensation that it received in the form of non-transaction-based markups on charges imposed by the clearing firm. There's only one other case that we were aware of prior to this point in time where the SEC had alleged that type of violative activity, and that was in a settlement back in December of 2018. And what these facts kind of generally involve is a situation where the clearing firm says, we are going to charge you X dollars, call it $5, for an execution charge. And many firms pass that through. But because of other services advisory firms may provide in the context of that transaction and perhaps others, they may mark up that fee such that rather than it being a $5 fee, the fee is, again, I'm just picking numbers, $650. And in fact, that $650, that collective fee, is disclosed to the client. What the SEC has alleged in this case and what it said in the prior settlement back in December of 2018 was that collective disclosure is not specific enough, that any sort of a markup of a fee passed through from the clearing firm for which the RIA adds a markup on top of it needs to be disclosed and disclosed at a level of specificity that reveals the revenue being paid within that to the advisory firm. So what that means in my very general example is the disclosure should be the $5 execution fee plus $1.50 for whatever service the advisory firm is providing. And then both of those dollar amounts are disclosed with that level of specificity. That then addresses the conflict of interest by way of full and fair disclosure. So those last two theories, I think may reveal areas that the SEC may be looking at, you know, from now into the foreseeable future. So while a lot of attention has been paid to 12b-1 fees and revenue sharing and getting back to the FAQ that was released on Friday, much of that FAQ talks about disclosures in the context of 12b-1 fees and revenue sharing. Also within there, while it doesn't get as much coverage, it does talk about other types of financial conflicts related to investment advisor compensation. And these two theories in this second case fall under those other conflicts. And so when folks read the FAQ from last Friday, it should be read very broadly to apply to conflicts such as these latter two allegations in this most recent complaint.
Now, if you all haven't looked at that guidance that came out last Friday, if you're a standalone investment advisor or if you're a dual registrant broker-dealer investment advisor, you really need to look at that. I think you will find the SEC's views of the disclosures of conflicts is much more demanding than what you probably thought it was. And Jim and Sandy and I have had a discussion that in Reg BI, the SEC has said that broker-dealers must, beginning June 30 of next year, make full and fair disclosure. Well, why am I beating a fair? Because that is the language that historically and currently is used for investment advisor disclosure. So the investment advisor disclosure now and the broker-dealer disclosure beginning June 30 of next year will both require full and fair disclosure with enough information that the investor can provide an informed consent, implicit or explicit. An informed consent, in my mind, means you look at it from the investor's perspective and say, is this enough information that the investor can truly understand what's going on and therefore can make an informed consent? Well, Jim was just talking about the $5 versus the $6.50, and that the extra $1.50 gets paid back to the advisor for services. Maybe that's the amount of information that an investor would need to know either I agree with that or I don't agree with that to make that decision. I mean, I could make an argument that would be what an investor would want to know. But my real point is not whether I can make an argument or not. My real point is to say I think you need to look at these disclosures that way. If you looked at your disclosures, does an investor know enough that they can make an informed consent to what's going on in terms of the conflict of interest and the possible impact it might have on somebody's on an advisor's decision making, not on your decision making because you're a good guy, but on some hypothetical advisor's decision making, such that they would favor themselves over the investor. I think Jim, you and Sandy and I talked a little bit, and we seem to concur that this is all merging, that the requirements are becoming more and more similar between broker dealers and investment advisors. Either of you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, the word I've used is convergence. I mean, you know, Sandy has been servicing broker-dealer clients for years. So, you know, her perspective, I think, Fred, would be helpful for how this convergence is taking place.
I think it is a brave new world for the broker-dealers. We've never before had disclosure requirements. That was always something that was in the lane of the investment advisor, and now we have both disclosure requirements and mitigation requirements and considerations of costs, all very new things for us. So with regard to just the standard but also the affirmative duties to disclose, I think there is a convergence.
Hello?
Yes, I'm
Jim and
here.
Brad.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you broke up a little. I don't know if it was on my end or yours, but anyway, let's move on. And actually, Sandy, we want to move on to you. We're just for everybody listening. We're starting a new little part of our Beltway program. It's called Parts and Pieces. Regulation best interest is so big. It was 500, 600, 700 pages long. Typewritten. It's 175 pages long. Fine print in the Federal Register. It covers a million things. So there's no way we can really deal with it comprehensively on a call like this. So we're starting a part of our program where each one, Sandy, will talk about what we call parts and pieces. We're going to break off one little piece of regulation best interest or some of the other associated guidance, and then Sandy will give us her thoughts on it. So, Sandy, back to you.
All right. Well, I promised to put a very fine point in what seems like a very big piece so that it doesn't make Fred nervous. But recently the FINRA released its 2019 report on examinations, findings, and observations, and I thought it might be front of mind for the broker-dealers or the joint registrants on this call. And specifically, one of the things that FINRA looked at in its exams and reported on was suitability. And interestingly, it starts its discussion about that by saying, currently, FINRA's suitability rule establishes obligations that are central to promoting ethical sales practices and high standards of professional conduct, and it cites to FINRA Rule 2111. But it also footnotes the fact that on June 5th, the SEC adopted the Reg BI package, and it indicates that, you know, the findings in this particular report are only for the existing FINRA suitability rules, but refers its audience to a topic page on SEC regulations best interest Reg BI. And just to be absolutely certain of how they're going to proceed, Robert Cook, who's the present CEO of FINRA, has indicated that it will be examining from now on compliance with Reg BI as opposed to FINRA's suitability rule, and that there's a significant amount of work for FINRA to do to retool its examination. It expects to be in relatively constant communications with the SEC to make sure that their examiners are trained to scope for the exams over time, and that they'll be collaborating with this, because as he categorized it, this is their rule, not ours. So since people might be now looking at that report and gearing up, as one should, for the Reg BI rule, the question becomes, it's likely that you all have written supervisory provisions on books and records for the standard supervisory rules, which is Rule 2111. The question is, What do you have to do to get ready to change that so that it's conducive to regulation based upon Reg BI? Well, Reg BI provides that in making a recommendation, an advisor, broker must exercise reasonable diligence, care, and skill to, quote, have a reasonable basis to believe that the recommendation is in the best interest of the particular retail customer based upon the retail customer's investment profile and the potential risks, rewards, and costs associated with the recommendation. On June 5th, in its disclosures, it gave an explanation to discussing exactly what it was looking for, and it said, you know, the broker-dealer exercises reasonable due care, diligence, care, and skill to understand the risks and rewards and costs of a recommendation, have a reasonable basis for the belief that the recommendation is in the best interest of a particular retail customer based upon that retail customer's investment profile, and the recommendation does not place the broker-dealer's interest ahead of the retail customer, and three, have a reasonable basis to believe that a series of transactions in the best interest of the retail customer and does not place the interest of the broker-dealer ahead of the
Sandy,
retail customer. Yes.
Sandy, you're
yes.
breaking up a little bit.
Oh, sorry.
You're breaking
is this
up
any
a
better?
Little bit.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
No.
Any better?
Yes.
Okay. I'm in the phone, so I'll just so what is different from the present, the proposed soon-to-be-enforced Reg BI and the present suitability rule? Well, it injects into the formula care and skill, which is different than it used to be. It injects cost, and it changes what was known as the quantitative analysis under the suitability rule, where you had to take into consideration a series of traits, not this specific trait, to make sure that it wasn't excessive for the client, because the prior quantitative analysis required de facto control by the broker, and the present one does not. It also changes the definition of retail customer. So under the prior rule, the suitability rule did not apply to institutional customers, and institutional customers included individuals with net worth over $50 million. Presently, retail customer includes any natural human being, regardless of what their net worth is. So there are specific differences in the rules, and the particular disclosure in June 2019 said that regulation best interest imposed a duty of care that enhanced existing suitability obligations, and Robert Cook indicated in a letter to the Senate that the difference really is that FINRA's suitability rule was implicitly requiring broker-dealers to recommend securities or transactions that were consistent with the customer's best interest, while the SEC's rule explicitly establishes that the customer's best interest is the overreaching standard of care. So there is a significant difference. It's worth looking at. This is the time to look at your books and records to determine what it is. I think the guidance that was given in the exam disclosures made by FINRA would be actually a nice place to start, because what they were looking at would be things they would be looking at even in coordination with the SEC under the new Reg BI rule. So the things they thought were noteworthy for the exams for 2019 were inadequate supervision of product exchanges. For instance, they were talking about suitability of recommendations that customer exchange certain products such as mutual funds.
Senator, you're breaking up again. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm going to hand back to you then.
Okay. Why don't we do that and then move on? And I think we've got a good idea of what some of the key changes are.
Okay.
Brad, it's time to go back to you. You know, we've talked off and on the Beltway calls about the possibility of some additional exemptions from the DOL for variable compensation. We've got that non-enforcement policy now for non-discretionary advice that would produce that type of prohibited transaction, and about a DOL fiduciary regulation. What's the latest word on whether we're going to get a regulation, whether we're going to get exemptions? What's going on?
Yeah, so the official word from DOL, according to the most recent regulatory agenda, is that there will be a proposal relating to presumably both the fiduciary rule and an exemption coming up in December. In practice, we had expected it sooner than that, but the departure of Secretary Acosta and the arrival of Secretary Scalia has affected that timetable. One of the issues, of course, is whether Secretary Scalia will get the opinion from Interior Ethics Council at Labor that would allow him to work on this matter, given his involvement as sort of the lead lawyer on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce and others who were successful in getting the Fifth Circuit to vacate the fiduciary rule. So we're waiting to see whether Secretary Scalia will be directly involved or not. What we anticipate is a new exemption that's replacing the old BIC exemption that, as you say, would address various sorts of variable compensation and other issues related to non-discretionary advice. That would include rollovers, among other issues, that would largely draw from the SEC and the new Reg BI and the RIA guidance in terms of the conditions that would need to be met for the exemption. The concept would be that you have essentially very similar conditions between DOL and SEC. At least that's what we have historically gleaned from what various department officials have said. The other question is, will they do more on the fiduciary rule and, for example, bring up again the idea of rollover advice typically being ERISA fiduciary advice instead of typically not being ERISA fiduciary advice? Currently, because one of the elements of the five-part test of what's ERISA fiduciary investment advice is regularly providing that advice. So because rollovers are one-time transactions, DOL has previously determined that most rollover advice is not fiduciary advice unless the advisor is speaking to a participant in a plan to which that advisor is already a fiduciary. In other words, you're a fiduciary to a plan participant in that plan works with you on a rollover, that would be a situation where that rollover advice is ERISA fiduciary advice. Otherwise, it generally would not be. The question is, will DOL expand the fiduciary definition to again encompass in some form rollover advice as fiduciary advice? And those are some of the big issues we're waiting to see. So presumably in the near future, we'll have much better idea of what's actually going to happen there and what's going to be proposed. But I think we probably also ought to point out the regulation that DOL just released as a proposal, if that makes sense to turn to that next, or if there's something else you wanted to say about the fiduciary situation, Fred.
But just to finish on the fiduciary, my sense is that the balls are up in the air right now, and we can't really give people any definitive answer. Is that accurate enough?
I think that is in some way accurate because, well, I do think they could conceivably achieve their official deadline of December for issuing the proposal. That is actually going to put us in a somewhat precarious position down the road. One, we don't know if they'll make December or not. Two, we don't actually know the content, though we have some informed speculation. But if they do issue the proposal in December, and then there's a 60-day comment period, and then they have to write the final rule, and then they issue the final rule, the exemption and rule, there's a real question as to whether that rule will stick, because a lot of that depends on the outcome of the next presidential election and who controls Congress, as to whether DOL itself tries to undo a rule that's been promulgated but not yet necessarily finalized under the law, or whether the Congressional Review Act could be used post the next election of Congress and the President, which depends on who wins. So there's an awful lot of variables up in the air, both in the short term as to what the rule will look like, and in the long term as to whether the rule, even if promulgated fully in the Trump administration, remains, depending on whether there's a second term, another president, et cetera. So there's a whole lot of uncertainty about the future of this rule.
Yeah, before you move on to the electronic delivery of disclosures and the DOL proposal, I just want to add one thing to what you said. Brad mentioned rollovers as being one area where at least some folks at the DOL would like to see a single rollover recommendation be a fiduciary act subject to the prudent man rule and the prohibited transaction rules. But if we focus only on that, we take our eye off the ball because the interpretation for investment advisors issued by the SEC on June 5th and applicable on July 12th, so already applicable, says that a rollover recommendation by an investment advisor is a fiduciary act subject to the duty of care, subject to the duty of loyalty, which in combination they call requirement to act in the best interest of the investor, in that case, the best interest of the participant. So that, for investment advisors, that's already there. There is a fiduciary standard, and based on what we've been able to glean, the process and the considerations is very similar to what the DOL would have required under its duty of care. Meanwhile, under regulation best interest, on June 30 of next year, the care obligation and the best interest standard and the rules generally apply to rollover recommendations. So for broker-dealers, a single rollover recommendation beginning June 30 of next year will be subject to the best interest standard of care, whereas right now it's subject to suitability, which I think we agree is a somewhat lower standard, and for example, less weight is given to cost under suitability. You know, the relative cost of the IRA versus the plan under suitability then would have to be given under the best interest standard. Okay, Brad, I had to get that off my mind because of the
I think that's a great point, Fred, because you're right. There is a securities law fiduciary obligation for RIAs. Under Reg BI, there will be more process and best interest recommendation issues. In both of those, where there's a conflict, which I think both of those standards would perceive rollover advice as being conflicted because of the ability to, you know, cause yourself to receive a fee based on the advice, the difference, I think, really between DOL's effort and where the SEC is the result of that conflict. With DOL, if it is ERISA fiduciary advice as well as securities fiduciary advice or regulation best interest covered recommendation, then you have a much more difficult time dealing with the conflict under ERISA, which is why you would need this new exemption to permit the compensation. Whereas Reg BI would require evaluation of mitigation, DOL would essentially prohibit the compensation unless there's an exemption that applies. So I think you're exactly right to point out that we will have simultaneously applicable standards with somewhat different results of that applicable standard if DOL and SEC all act together. The other thing I should have mentioned is, of course, this DOL exemption, one of the big questions will be, what would the conditions be for non-SEC-governed entities? So, for example, if someone who's operating under a state insurance license makes an insurance recommendation in connection with a rollover, what would the conditions that DOL require for that? Because that typically wouldn't be subject to the SEC. Anyway, moving on to...
Could you give us a quick update on the e-delivery? Because we need to allow some time for questions, and we're at 9:53.
Yeah, we'll be real quick. I'll be real quick here. This is actually a fairly significant improvement. What DOL is proposing, and it'll be about a 30-day comment period, what DOL is proposing is that there would be a new safe harbor for electronic delivery, whereby a plan who is either received from a participant an email address or a smartphone number, or who assigns those to people as part of their employment, would be able to send a one-time paper notice to everyone that gives them the right to opt out of electronic notice, but otherwise would then be able to send, for applicable notices in the future, an email to those folks or similar electronic communication identifying that information, a disclosure of some sort has been provided, with a brief description of it and information about how to go access it on the internet, on a website, and also how to elect paper if they again want to change their minds. Essentially, it reverses the default that some of the other safe harbors and requirements have made, which is a presumption in favor of paper. This would now provide a mechanism that's an optional mechanism for plans to elect to use electronic communication as the default. A couple of quick things. The participant would have the right to either on a notice-by-notice basis seek paper or on a global basis seek paper. So, for example, I could say I want a paper copy of my SPD, but I'm generally okay otherwise with receiving electronic notices, or I could say, no, I only want paper. It does create some conditions and obligations to make sure those addresses are still valid. There has to be a mechanism for the plan sponsor to tell when those notices are no longer being received, and to address that. Also, this is only applicable to pension plan notices, not to welfare plan notices. And there are a number of additional conditions. I think one of the things people might want to focus on in the comments is the applicability date. DOL proposes that this rule would, this optional safe harbor, would be available in the first calendar year, first day of the calendar year after this rule is promulgated. But as we're nearing the end of this year, it raises a question as to whether this would put it off until January 2021, if finalized, or whether it would be available sooner. That might be something people want to focus on in the comments. But read through the conditions. Look for comments about things like how do they not be static on the technology employed, how do they avoid the regulation locking in rules that may change in the future in terms of the technology. There's a lot of things for sponsors to think about and comment on this rule.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you very much. Derek, let's open it up to questions. And once you announce that, then I will ask Jim one question that was pre-submitted since we seem to have covered most of them. So, Derek?
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question over your phone at this time, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. And again, that is star 1 on your telephone keypad to signal for a question at this time.
Thanks, Derek. And Jim Lundy, let me ask you a question. You gave one example, if I recall correctly, of how a disclosure would need to be made. There are a couple of questions we got about what are some ideas of best practice disclosures. Is there something else that you could give us an example?
Yeah, so in a way, it's a very broad question, and it does depend on the facts and circumstances of a particular business. So, but let me answer it this way, Fred. Before getting into the disclosure, I think what a best practice is that I think some firms may do and some may not be able to do from a resource perspective is get a handle on the financial conflicts in the first place and have some sort of a framework, a documented framework, a matrix that has all of those conflicts listed, who they're with, what they involve, and then how they're graded. And by that I mean, are they material, are they not material, do they require mitigation, don't they require mitigation? I think all that foundational work needs to be in place. And some firms I know already do that. And again, depending on the resources folks have, that may be something that may not be practical. But from a best practice, I think that is an important foundation for what the disclosures are. Building from that, specificity and specifics are words that are used throughout the RIA guidance. When you look at the FAQ that came out last week, they give specific examples and they talk about the interplay of the guidance and the Form ADV guidance on where and how some of these conflicts should be disclosed. My only concern is that a lot of that FAQ focuses on 12B1 fees and revenue sharing, which have dominated much of the coverage in this space. Most firms, I think, are now well aware of needing to make improvements if they need to in that regard. The issue is, what are the other types of conflicts that may need to be disclosed? And again, that gets back to the business and what the conflicts are. So having that foundational assessment and understanding of what those are is the important first step. And then when it gets to the disclosure, you need to be as specific as possible. If that means breaking apart the markup and the clearing charge, as we talked about earlier, for a particular transaction-based fee, then that's what needs to occur. What I have said to people is that the concept of the ADV being considered a client brochure, I think, is a little bit of a misnomer with the way the enforcement division has been treating that. They very much treat it as a regulatory disclosure document. So firms need to be thinking of it the same way.
Yeah, I would, just to add to what Jim said, I don't think people, particularly investment advisors, but also broker-dealers, are really focused on the form CRS yet, because that doesn't have to be handed out until the May 1 to June 30 period of next year to existing clients. But the form CRS will cross-reference the ADV and website, other material. And I think you need to be thinking in terms of you know, how you're going to link your ADV to your form CRS if you're an investment advisor and to your website and to other disclosures. Also, for broker-dealers, the same thing. How is your CRS going to tied in by links to specific information on your website about costs and compensation? So there's a lot that these disclosures will ultimately need to be coordinated with your form CRS, which is brand new, so you probably haven't even given much thought to it yet. Anyway, Derek, do we have any questions?
We have no current questions in the queue, but once again, that's star one on your telephone keypad.
Okay, Brad, let me ask you something. There was a question that came in about collective investment trusts, and said they seem to be increasingly popular in retirement plans, but there was some sense of skepticism in the question about maybe they're not transparent or not regulated enough. Can you comment on that?
Well, yeah, that's been sort of an interesting strain of criticism that we've heard emerging as CITs have become more popular again. It's probably worth remembering that CITs were some of the original investments in some of these ERISA plans, and the rise of mutual funds sort of caused a shift away from them, and now we're seeing a shift back. I think for a lot of providers of CITs, in fact, they're using some of the exact same strategies in their mutual fund offerings that they are in their CITs. So in essence, they're being managed in the same way. The difference is, and the person asking the question is correct, the difference is that the form of the regulation of that investment vehicle is different, and there are more regulatory requirements related to mutual funds, for example, than CITs. I don't know that I would necessarily agree, though, that that means that CITs don't have sufficient regulation or aren't transparent. I think that is something that could vary from CIT to CIT, but that's part of what fiduciaries would look at is, when I make an investment, can I understand the investment, what it's doing, and how it works? And I think, in general, CITs do provide enough clarity for fiduciaries to be able to make those decisions. So I haven't seen any real cause, I guess I would say, for there to be a concern about plans investing in CITs. I think it's been moving sort of as an organic and natural event and hasn't really tripped any wires that we should be overly concerned about.
Okay. Well, good. Operator, Derek, any questions?
We have no questions in the queue at this time.
Well, Jim Dolan, I think we're done with our time. I was going to try to sneak in one more Q&A, but it's not there. So, Jim, thank you, and do you want to wrap this thing up for us?
Happy to do that, Fred. Looks like we answered all the questions. Another great call. Again, I want to thank everyone for taking some time out of your day to join us. Our next call is scheduled for January. We haven't decided the date yet, but we hope you join us there for our first call of 2020. And again, just want to thank Drinker Biddle for the partnership, some great information today, and I hope everyone has a great rest of their day. And with that, I'll turn it back to the operator to close out the call.
Thank you, sir. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's call. We do thank you for your participation.